Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
This is the Progressive Britain History Project, part of the Progressive Britain podcast. In each episode, we look at different aspects of the Labour Party's past with the aim of promoting a clearer, hopefully, understanding of its contested history. Perhaps busting a few myths on the way, maybe creating a few as well. Introducing some new ways of thinking and making connections between Labour's history, its present and its future. My name's Stephen Fielding. I'm Professor of Political History at the University of Nottingham, and I co-present the podcast along with Laura Beers, Professor Laura Beers, who's Professor of History at the American University in Washington. So hello, Laura.
Hey there, Steve.
Today in our episode, we've got another professor, and I looked up the collective noun for professors, and it's a pomposity of professors. We have we're not going to be pompous in this podcast. We've got Professor Glenn O'Hara, who is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Oxford Brookes, and who's written too many good things for me to be nice about him. And he's currently working on a book about New Labour, which we're all looking forward to seeing when it comes out in the not too dim and distant future, hopefully, Glenn.
Yeah, we hope so. I think pandemic and homeschooling has derailed my plans. But in within the next few years, there will be a massive tome on New Labour. Yes,
good. But the reason why we've hauled Glenn on to be interrogated in this podcast is because he's written a chapter about Harold Wilson, his reputation and his achievements, the two things being somewhat different, in an edited collection, a collection called Rethinking Labour's Past, which was edited by Nathan Yule and contains other very good chapters, Glenn's being one of them, of course, that seek to sort of rethink, as the title implies, certain aspects of Labour's history. So Before we start to throw questions and have a chat with Glenn about that, about Harold Wilson, there's a 2020 survey of Labour Party members which suggests that 25% of them don't really know that much about Harold Wilson. So if I just very, very briefly give the sort of very much edited highlights of Harold Wilson's career and why he might be interesting, that might be useful for at least some of our listeners. I mean, in 1963, that's when Harold Wilson became Labour leader. Unexpectedly, Hugh Gaitskell died. We talked about Hugh Gaitskell in a previous podcast. And the reason why, I guess, Labour members, when they're asked, actually had a very favourable impression of Harold Wilson, those that knew something about him. The reason why is because in 1964, he led the Labour Party to end that nearly 14 years of Conservative governments. And you had united the party behind a kind of very optimistic can-do rhetoric about modernising Britain, making it fairer, more productive, to unleash the productive forces, the white heat of British industry to the benefit of all. Ends Conservative Party rule only just a bit, gets a minority, a majority in the House of Commons. But then in 1966, builds on that as Prime Minister and gets a big landslide. So basically, Harold Wilson, arguably, in the 1960s, he had the political tools to live up to those hopes and aspirations. The question being, did he, the extent to which he did, and why he didn't do it? We can talk about that. And the government ends, again, unexpectedly, in 1970. It was an election everyone thought Wilson would win. He loses, some say, because of the issue of immigration, which is something we might want to think about. And then in the next few years, his leader of the opposition has a difficult time trying to keep the party together. The left is moving further away. The right is becoming more and more aggressive, and particularly over the issue of Europe and the continued membership of Britain in the EEC, which Wilson manages, thanks to Tony Benn's sort of very interesting device of having a referendum if Labour gets back into office to confirm or not the decision of the Heath government to enter the EEC. Labour somehow manages to get back into office in February of 74 in the midst of an economic crisis, but only has a minority position, doesn't actually have a majority in the Commons. Wilson builds on that in October, but only gets a slight majority in the House of Commons and has to face terrible economic problems, world economic problems, big inflation, a recession, lots of strikes, and he starts the process of creating a social contract, relying on the unions essentially to get the Labour government through this difficult period. But then, unexpectedly, lots of unexpecteds in Wilson's career. In early 1976, he resigns. He must be one of the very few prime ministers to go before people say, "Why aren't you going?" Very different kind of context for the one that we've got in the present moment with Boris Johnson. So that's Wilson in a nutshell. Now, Glenn, I'm not sure if that's a fair summary. I will have missed lots out. We can go over what I've missed out and whatever. But in your chapter, you focus a lot on his changing reputation from being seen possibly like a crook when he leaves office in 76, rather under a cloud, to today being, you know, seen as being someone that, well, Keir Starmer said that of the last 50 years, leaders of the last 50 years, he thought that Wilson was the one that he would aspire to being if he could be. He was the best leader as far as he was concerned. So what do you, you know, generally speaking, why do you think there has been this shift in reputation?
Well, this is a kind of how long have you got? Because I can bore about this for hours. But I mean, I think there's a couple of things I'd highlight straight away, which is the first is just the distance of time lends enchantment. You know, when you look at the details of governing, you know, when he left office, there's this quite discredited list of honours, the so-called Lavender List, which makes him look bad. He'd become a kind of slow-moving kind of sweeper figure in, if you want a football analogy, where he wasn't very quick on his feet anymore. So people's immediate memory of him was, well, this was someone who kind of had his best years and had gone out in a kind of a bit of a smell. But actually, you know, when you zoom back, I mean, this is a time of immense achievement. And I think, to be honest, this will be, seeing as I'm writing it, a little bit like the history of Blairism, which is, you know, when Blair leaves office, the Brownites essentially to some extent push him out. But when you zoom back, there's massive achievements. I mean, I think, you know, even Theresa May and David Cameron, revisionist historians will come and say, oh, they did this. You know, David Cameron passed gay marriage. So there is the distance of time. It does lend a kind of sympathy. And there's a human sympathy for Harold as well. But also, as we get away from his period in office, it's just things in the UK look so bad at different points, early 80s, kind of now, last few years maybe, in terms of real wage growth or inequality or public services, that there's so many things that he does, Wilson in power, that look good. Just one example is, you know, health centres for general practitioners, which bring together lots of different types of health practitioners that really had been an unfulfilled element of the NHS Act in 1948, that actually, when you look at it properly, if real wages surge, people are going to look back and say, well, this isn't as bad as kind of the little minutiae of politics like the Lavender List make it look. So there's two things there.
I mean, Laura, have you got any particularly strong view about Wilson? I mean, I'm quite conflicted. I don't know what you think about him.
I mean, I think it speaks to your poll that you cited at the beginning, Stephen, because, you know, as a Labour historian, he's the one Labour prime minister, the one of only four, right, about which I have the least strong opinions. But the opinions that I do have about him tend to be, less about his economic policies, which, while ambitious, never play themselves out, more about the kind of successes in terms of modernizing Britain on a cultural level. I think that legacy, the fact that he, the things that he did have created, in some ways, the modern cultural landscape that we now take for granted, sort of akin to Glenn's statement that Cameron probably will even get a positive nod in terms of, legalizing gay marriage, make it kind of easier, because we take those things for granted, to forget than reflecting back on the kind of seeming descent into chaos in the late 60s and early 1970s in terms of the economy, which is not something that should be entirely laid at his feet, right? But for which I think he gets easily dismissed by history.
He does that in his own person as well. You know, he's more of an everyman than a lot of other leaders and a lot of other politicians at that time. You know, what he wears, how he talks with a kind of overtly northern accent, the Gannex Mac, the Labrador, the shopping in the co-op, going to the Scilly Isles for your holiday. He modernises Britain just in himself. He's kind of with the times. He's comfortable talking about football and music, and kind of going to the pub. He is someone who actually embodies, to some extent, literally embodies what it is to look like kind of middle-aged, middle-class, black-coated worker of the time.
His background was relatively humble, certainly compared to the Conservative prime ministers that he succeeded in, and also like Hugh Gaitskell as well. Although there is a suggestion that he was playing up some of that. He smoked a pipe in public, but in private he smoked cigars. But nonetheless, he was, from a relatively humble background. But the thing that Keir Starmer identified as to why he was the best leader from the last 50 years was because he said he united the party behind him. Now, Keir Starmer said this when he was seeking the leadership of the Labour Party, where one of his primary goals, at least ostensibly, was to unite the Labour Party. But if that was true, did he really unite the party? Because it completely fell apart, certainly after he left, which doesn't suggest he was doing a terribly good job. And I remember Shirley Williams on the right of the party, hated him, viscerally hated him. The left didn't like him much, but for different reasons. But Shirley Williams basically hated him, or at least was very critical of him, because his primary aim was to unite, keep the party united. And she said, well, the Labour Party shouldn't have been kept united. It should have been resolved one way or the other. So I just wonder if what you think about that as a unifier.
I think this depends on where we stand about kind of Labourism. And I'm ambivalent about that personally, because I think what Wilson would have said was that, look, under first past the post, there can only be one progressive governing party, and it has to have a core. It can have a left, it can have a right, but it's got to have a leader that probably most people hate. And, he would say in private, look, I go out and people just throw excrement at me all day. That's my job. And could anyone have done better? Callaghan does quite well, doesn't he, in 76 and 77, holding the government together during the International Monetary Fund crisis. But the extent of that crisis over Europe, I think if you hadn't had someone as strangely cynical but talented as Harold, the Labour Party could just have been obliterated. If you watch that Jenkins-Benn debate on Panorama, I mean, these are people who hate each other more than anybody else hates each other in the whole world, even professors. So, this is a party that is almost impossible to hold together. I think that's why Starmer thinks about him, because that's what Starmer's challenge is coming in 2020, isn't it?
Well, also, on that point, I mean, he holds the party together, arguably, at the moment of 1997, and arguably with people hating him from either direction equally as much, Tony Blair brings the party together, right, and brings them back into power on a much larger landslide than Wilson, you know, and was, you know, barely had a functioning government for much of his time in power. But you look at this question, Stephen, I think it's a bit of a cheat, right? Because Starmer was asked, which Labour leader of the past 50 years do you most admire? So he can't say Attlee, right? Long Bailey kind of fudges it and says Attlee anyway and has to be reminded that was more than 50 years ago. He can't say Blair because Blair has become so toxic despite having won multiple elections for Labour, right? And, you know, he can't say Callaghan, even though, as you say, Callaghan did a reasonable job because Callaghan's government ends in the ignominy of the winter of discontent, right? So he's got very few candidates. And in that sense, you know, he's got to turn to Wilson because, you know, Wilson is one of only three Labour leaders to actually have won a majority. And in the aftermath of the whole Brexit debacle, one of the things that can be said about Wilson is he managed to at least get the country through and get his very fractured party through the first Brexit referendum, right? So it's, you know, in the land of pygmies, you know, I mean, I guess you have a kind of, I'm not sure it's really saying Wilson was the world's greatest leader or that Wilson was truly a unifier, but Wilson, despite being hated by the left and right, managed to kind of hold the team together for a while.
Blair as the silent man of Labour history here is really important. The man who cannot be mentioned, you know, the absence, the shadow of in the background of the Labour Party, because Blair is someone who very similarly speaks demotic and is very, very much like, you know, inverted commas, average middle-class voters in the 90s, and is a brilliant speaker in the same way Wilson was a brilliant speaker, and speaks in kind of ways that are summarised conventional wisdom, but shove it in a certain direction. But you can't say Blair because this is the great unspeakable. I think that will change, just like Wilson, but it will take a long time.
Yes, well, probably had this question come up 30 years ago, right, in the early 80s as opposed to the early 20s, I guess that's 40 years ago. Then you couldn't have said Wilson. But now time, you know, time's the great healer or whatever. And with some distance, Wilson doesn't seem that bad.
Except Wilson demonstrates Blair's challenge over Iraq, because Wilson keeps out of Vietnam, which is the great thing we forget, really divided Labour in the late 60s. And yet the left still basically pile into him for being a kind of American lickspittle and kind of running dog of capitalism. So really, Wilson shows how you can't get it right on that transatlantic relationship with actual resorts of force.
I mean, it's interesting because there are some parallels between more than just that you just said, Glenn, between Wilson and Blair. I mean, it was interesting the way in which when the Iraq War happened, and even before that, Tony Benn, who in the end came to be, I mean, he liked him as a human being, but he hated him as a political figure by the 1970s, was a big critic. And the left in general was a big critic of Wilson. They started to use Wilson as an example with which to attack Blair. So they did say, oh, well, at least Harold Wilson didn't enter the Vietnam War, even though they criticised him in the ways that you said that they did. But also, Wilson, because there's this brief phase, isn't there, in when he's leader of the opposition in the early days of being a prime minister, when he does the famous speech that everybody kind of knows the one bit of promising the white heat of the technological revolution, to unleash all these forces, to kind of attack the kind of the elitism of the Conservatives, to unleash the grammar school talent, you know, humble people will be given a chance. And all of that, he's got a wonderful rhetoric and talks about a new Britain, modernising Britain. And this is all very Tony Blair. I mean, actually, people did draw the comparison at the time between the two, that Wilsonian rhetoric was very similar, even though Blair himself didn't want to be associated with Harold Wilson and corporatism and using the state in the way that Wilson did. So I wonder if, I mean, that's something that maybe Starmer certainly does seem to lack. You know, that at least we don't really know how genuine Wilson was in his rhetoric, but he had a rhetoric, and Starmer really hasn't really created that sense of, you know, we know where we're going and we're going in this direction and we want to take everyone with us. So I suppose we're kind of damning Wilson with faint praise, but at least he had the rhetoric. Or am I running out of road here?
It's a very broad church that Wilson brings into government as well. It's got a big left-wing edge, but with George Brown, for instance, it's got a really solid trade union and right-wing edge. A little bit like we often forget, you know, the Blair cabinet, the first Blair cabinet has got the left in it. It's got, you know, Clare Shaw, Robin Cook from the soft left, Michael Meacher is environment minister, you know, some left-wing people. And there's a bit of a worry, I think, about the Starmer project with some people on the left of the Labour Party, not the Corbynite left, but the softer left, that he is running a very one-dimensional office, Keir, that it's a kind of Blair tribute act. Now, I think that's unfair, but I think that the problem of managing a very vociferous Labour Party while keeping its left-wing edge, which Wilson and Blair early on definitely do, is going to be really difficult for Starmer, especially when one of the secrets of that technological determinism you're talking about is that there was money to spend, there was growth. If Starmer has no money to spend, it's going to be much harder.
Just to follow up on that, he's walking a fine line, isn't he, Glenn? Because he has to draw a line under the Corbyn project. You had that ridiculous, you know, attempt for Boris to pin him as would a Corbynista in a, you know, Islington blazer or something like that in PMQs the other week. But I mean, so he's got to create that distance. But he does flank himself, sort of thinking about him in Parliament, right, with Rachel Reeves on one shoulder and Angela Rayner on the other, and is attempting both, I think, to sort of show that he's progressive in terms of his gender politics, but also that he can somehow bring together the two sides of the party and, you know, excluding that which has, you know, the other thing which cannot be named, right? The, you know, the Corbyn element. And it's a difficult balancing act for him, though, right? And he also has the potential, arguably. I mean, he's our, you know, since Wilson, he's Wilsonian in that he wasn't a grammar school boy, but he goes to a, you know, privatized former grammar school on one of these Thatcherite scholarships, right? He does have that sort of son from humble background makes good rhetoric if he could only lean into it, but he doesn't seem to have Wilson's comfort with that demotic, right? And telling the story about himself as a bigger story about Britain, the way that Wilson did.
Well, the reason you're being very fair, as is your wont, is that, you know, Starmer's position when he comes in is much weaker than Blair and Wilson's. I mean, taking over from Gaitskill, who was becoming respected by lots of Tories in the country, had a kind of Tory mean to him as well, a kind of manner which is attracted some voters, or taken over from John Smith. Well, these people have laid the groundwork and you can just stand on it. I mean, you know, let's face it, in December 2019, Labour had yet another near-death experience that Starmer's done pretty well at sweeping up the debut from. I mean, one of the secrets of Wilson and Blair is they've got a huge tree of fruit that just falls on them of policies, these great policies that Smith and Gaitskill and Kinnock, of course, have been farming for a decade, you know.
Maybe we should look at, you know, what the position that Wilson sort of, well, where did he go with this kind of good position, this solid position that Glenn has kind of suggested, you know, Gaitskill having done the policies, many people fed up with the Tories already, the economy actually not doing too badly. So he's got this great mobilising rhetoric. So what went wrong? That's usually what people were asking the 1960s on the left, you know, with all these hopes. So what were his greatest successes and failures in the 1960s? Because that's really, that's where his reputation stands or falls, isn't it? That government of 64 to 70.
Well, for me, there's one big headline, which is defence spending falls below education spending, which surges. So essentially what you see is a Britain that is creating itself a balance of payments crisis all the time, not on the private side, not on the export side, but with defence spending, mostly east of Suez, but all around the world with, you know, multi-carrier fleets in most oceans. And instead of that, as that spending falls, partly by necessity, you get a massive expansion of secondary school spending and higher education spending, including his own pet project of the Open University, which is a complete, I think, reorientation of the British economy from that kind of David Edgerton warfare state economy to a knowledge economy. And I think put together with all of the things that happened in the 80s and 90s, one of the secrets of the British economy when it surges around the time of the millennium is about its actually successful education sector. Those of us who work in its education sector right now, inculcating creativity and increasing investment in skills, if you want to put it in that crude kind of way. So for me, the big secret is Britain is reorientated away from the imperial Commonwealth role and towards a modern social democratic economy. And it never gets the Wilsonian period the credit for that. Never. There you go. There's some big, bold claims there.
Yes, that's one I've not heard. I've never heard that one actually put forward.
We aim to please. So there's some good. There's a new argument that's come out.
Okay. But more generally, in terms of the economy, I mean, Wilson wanted to unleash the white heat of technological change. He wanted to shift, you know, an economy that was growing, but it wasn't growing as fast as the French, the German, the Italian, the Japanese, and of course, the American economy. It was falling back. And to what extent did, you know, and had a Ministry of Technology, you know, they had a Department of Economic Affairs, a whole new kind of organization, administration that was meant to get the economy moving and developing in new and exciting ways. What happened to that? What happened to that promise?
Well, I'm afraid to say that, as all truly boring people say, I'm actually an expert in this. And I think the one of the headlines there is it does succeed. Growth does accelerate and productivity accelerates and real wages accelerate altogether, which, of course, is what you want. But, of course, inflation comes into the equation towards the very end of the 60s, which we probably don't have time to talk about. But the first thing to say is it does succeed in some ways. A growth orientation of the economy is, for instance, in regional policy, is pumped up. Second thing to say is some of those technological initiatives do fail, because what they do is they glue together lots of small companies, like in ICL or in the car industry, for instance, just as the Macmillan government had done, without addressing really their functional management problems, because you just glue loads of poor companies together. You just get one big poor company, right? Well, that was in some ways unavoidable, but below that kind of headline, I think, of these big beasts that don't work very well through the Industrial Reorganisation Corporation, I think we do get, you know, in the water industry, in anti-pollution, in pharmaceuticals, we get some far less glamorous but no less important breakthroughs spun out by Department of Science Industrial Research, for instance, the government's hydrological office. Very, very boring stuff, but actually very, very important for the fact that Britain, all the things we don't hear about in terms of the British economy, it's a pharma powerhouse, for instance, as COVID was eventually going to show.
And you get also, I mean, I've been teaching George Orwell this semester, and sort of one of Orwell's real dreams about the evolution of socialism is the growth of this kind of, you know, educated technocrat science sector and this kind of growth of the middle class, which he hopefully argues, right, is going to erode class distinctions and class hierarchy. And one of the other things you can say about the Wilson governments is this is a period where inequality is probably at its lowest that it's ever, well, pessimistically, you could say that it's ever going to get, but certainly that it ever has gotten in modern British history, right? I mean, this is a period where you do have a kind of burgeoning middle, and that the kind of excesses at either end of the spectrum, while still present, are less dramatic either than they are in the earlier period or than that they will become again first under Tony Blair, right? Because for all that there is much that can be said about Blair, he wasn't that concerned about inequality, and that had long-term consequences, which we're still living with.
Yeah, I mean, throughout this period, inequality falls, and it falls propitiously. It doesn't just drift downwards, it plunges. And it ends up its lowest in 1979, as you suggest.
Is that a deliberate act of the government, or is it? Or I mean, trade unions are becoming increasingly, you know, they're becoming bigger. This is leading on to one of the issues that the Wilson government kind of headline, at least of the Wilson government, had issues with, that the unions were very powerful, and as people have proven, powerful unions actually does help, you know, reduce inequality. And there were lots of strikes. And the Wilson government had difficulties with that, and seemed to believe that, you know, one of the blockages to expanding the economy faster than they were doing was that the unions were a problem. And in fact, Wilson, I mean, because I've gone through the National Archive for some of this, Wilson was very much seen the unions as an issue, as a problem. And there's this one remarkable, because I'm determined to say this, that there's one remarkable incident sometime in the early time of his government when there's a threatened milkman strike, right? When you know, Britain used to have people delivering milk to doors, and they were threatening to go on strike in the London area. And Wilson's immediate response was, let's send in the army to man the milk floats, right? And civil servants had to say, well, if you're going to do that, you have to declare a state of emergency. And then he backed off. So Wilson's sort of attitude towards the unions was interesting, but he's generally criticised, at least from the left, of just focusing on the unions as a problem and actually going along with the Conservatives in that regard. I mean, is that fair to look at it like that?
And to follow on, Glenn, because I would actually love to know the answer to this. I just don't. I mean, do you think it is more trade unionism or the growth of the knowledge economy and genuine increases in social mobility that leads to declining inequality in this period?
Well,
and what are the drivers of that?
Well, what I would say is there's a huge number of factors, and any government, because it happens across the West, so any government is just kind of riding the tiger, right, on the back. One of the points is housing. So housing costs fall so much that you can buy a house for £600-700 in the London suburbs. That's still a lot when you're earning £5-10 a week, but that's between you, but that's easily affordable for young couples. And of course, remember, the age at first marriage plunges to its earliest ever. Got very early family formation, got a lot of saving going on. You've got cheap housing, including subsidised council housing, housing association housing. You've got a ferment in education where about 12-14% of the population are being shoved into very academic schools from all sorts of backgrounds, which of course is like spinning the tombola on social mobility. So you've got a huge number of things going on, some of which, as you sort of suggest, the Wilson government slows down, because of course it comprehensivisation is, it looks a lot more like grammar schools than in many ways than people think, but it's still different. I mean, I think I should go back to the union point, which is that I think Wilson's suspicion of the unions is not unions per se. It's the fact that the unions he knew in the 1940s were losing control of their grassroots through the kind of shop steward movement and through wage drift and through radicalism at local plants. So what Wilson's worried about, and why corporatism is in some ways a good idea, is he wants union bosses to get hold of them and control them. So it's not unionism per se that he doesn't like. It's the fact that, you know, for instance, communist infiltration, which he blames for the dock strike, has got hold of the unions and is denuding the unions of power. It's not that they're too powerful, it's they don't have any power, they can't control their members. What he wants is to order the commanding heights of the economy, but increasingly the economy is so complex you can't do that. That's one of the problems he runs into, I think.
Well, do you think it's the seeming failure to kind of, you know, be the puppeteer and orchestrate the economy in positive ways from above, you know, from the commanding heights of the 60s and 70s that then leads new labor to more or less abandon that project and focus on kind of tweaking from the margins as opposed to kind of puppeteering from the top?
Well, what I'd say to put in my way to put a positive spin on that new labor aspect, which is that essentially the new labor's analysis of Wilsonism is it's too many tactics, which drains all your energy by trying to micromanage. And what you need is an industrial strategy. And what you need is a public sector strategy, not managing these things. So you set in stone the structure and then you let more devolution take control. Now, actually, of course, as we know, that's also hypermanaged by the Brown Treasury so that you have 126, you know, public service agreements. So it doesn't always work like that. But essentially, the new Labour analysis of Wilsonism is that by attempting to manage things, it manages nothing.
Well, given that's a sort of fairly mixed kind of record maybe on the economy, but one of the things that people, when they look back on that period, and it's kind of a universal acclamation for the progressive social reforms that occur under the Wilson government, whether Wilson himself was that keen on all of them, because he was quite a conservative kind of a guy, but he allowed various permissive reforms about abortion, about decriminalising homosexuality. There were some modest measures with regard to women. I mean, Barbara Castle banged the table and got at least a commitment to equal pay in just the dying days of that government. I mean, that there generally seem to be sort of positive aspects of the Wilson government, and actually something that New Labour did continue. I mean, the social liberalism of that government. I mean,
yeah.
Is it completely fair to give Wilson the credit for this, or was it maybe it was going to happen anyway?
I think one of the things you've got to remember about Wilson is that originally he was a liberal, and I think on social issues I would see him as in the mould of a kind of tolerationist, which is, you know, if you want to do things in your private home, that's great, that's fine, and the state shouldn't inquire or intervene. He's not in the more advanced progressive mould of a kind of celebratory mould of social change, as you suggest, Steve. But he's quite happy to go with the moment and to sort of burnish his government and his reputation with these reforms. And in general, he's a bit like one of those conservatives who huffs and puffs a lot about social change, but actually when the chips are down, he actually thinks it's a good thing. And in some of it, I suspect, is a pose, especially as he gets older. And these kind of social movements are a bit more of a puzzle to him, as they are to most of us as we get older. And he is really driven. You spoke earlier about his background. His dad had been unemployed. He went to Australia when he was young, and he thought a lot of Australia as a kind of classless place. His uncle was an Australian politician. He was driven by this kind of hatred of snobbish condescension and kind of stopping the life chances of minorities as people would have seen them then. So there was a genuine passion there. It's just that this didn't take his real interest, because really his real interest was in the economy, and really it was in stats and data. He was an obsessive data person. He loved all of that, something I very much sympathise with. So it just, these social issues didn't really take his attention, that the highlight of his brain, which was very powerful, dynamic brain, but quite, it could be quite narrow. It focused on task after task after task.
Well, how, Glenn, then, I mean, in a place where you see an intersection of kind of data and statistics and social issues, I mean, how would you assess his performance in terms of minorities? And I know you've said in other spaces that kind of, you know, broader social anxieties about immigration kind of undercut his ability to do much for the minority community in Britain. But, you know, this is a place where statistics in terms of educational and job performance and differentials in real wages were existing and were something that a kind of technocrat could identify and seek to tackle, but where maybe there was less progress made and where there are certainly now intergenerational legacies with which any potential Starmer government, mm-hmm. You know, were it to come to power, would have to tackle.
Well, the first thing to say is that statistics on those kind of topics are really crude in the 60s, and they hardly exist sometimes. And Wilson puts in place, I wrote an Economic History Review article, should you wish to subject yourself to 40 pages of this, about his statistical reform program. So the first thing to say is the Wilson government sets out to find out about married women's pay, for instance, because one of the things they want to do is for women after childbirth to come back into the labour force. That's not because they're enormously progressive. It's because there's a labour shortage and they don't want to lose the labour, for instance. So the first thing to say is that they set out on a data reform programme, which you'd expect from a kind of wartime civil servant like Wilson, who worked on the Beveridge Report, worked on the stats of creating the welfare state. But I think the second thing is that there is a deeper commitment here to a fairer society. It's just that fairer society will be forged by, I think you used the word technocracy, be forged by planning, which is not economic planning, social planning. So via health centres, via better housing, via, you know, things I've written about, like, you know, hot and cold water in the home upstairs and downstairs, society will become so much better that you'll have more time to relax into a more progressive, a more tolerationist ethos. It's a very optimistic creed. I mean, shared by lots of conservatives as well, isn't it? But basically, it's got this, perhaps, as we look back, misguidedly optimistic view, which is that as things get better, all the angles will be knocked off kind of these social divides and these deep-seated social hatreds, like immigration. So, for instance, educational priority areas, which the Wilson government brings in, one of the indicators for getting the money for these areas is not speaking English as a first language for their children in the school. So the idea is basically you can ameliorate and you can actually change things.
Well, that's really, it's interesting you bring up migration, because I think that's probably the last topic we can discuss, and it's actually very, very important, and probably still very, well, it still is a very relevant kind of an issue, particularly for Keir Starmer and the present policy on refugees and what Labour's position is on immigration. Because 1970 was, it was said anyway, to be an election that was lost from Labour because of a shift of working class votes to the Conservatives, thanks to Enoch Powell, on the basis of, you know, quite virulently racist opinion to stop black immigration and to get black immigrants out of the country and to back where they came from in the rhetoric. And I just wonder how you thought about how Wilson tackled that challenge. I mean, it was a challenge that was there all the way through the 1960s, and it became more and more prominent, like I say, with Enoch Powell and his Rivers of Blood speech. And from my, I mean, I'm kind of myself, like I'm about Wilson as a whole, kind of in two minds. I mean, his government introduces the first race relation acts and seems to legislate against prejudice, but at the same time introduces racist immigration restrictions. I mean, they are racist. I mean, they stop black members of the Commonwealth coming, but let's keep the white ones keep coming in. So I just wonder what you thought about that as a strategy. I mean, whether it could be said to have worked. And I guess, as I say, it's probably one of the issues that's most relevant from the Wilson era that's relevant to the Starmer era.
Well, again, how long have we got? But I think it does and it doesn't work, which is a really weaselly answer politically. Of course, it looks very suspicious to us personally today and our personal views. So essentially, the 68 Act that you're talking about is an attempt to prevent Kenyan Asians entering the country while allowing white British citizens and subjects from around the Commonwealth so they can still come into the country. Essentially, if you've got British forebears who were born in the UK, then you can come in. And if you haven't, but you've got British passport, then you can't. And that's really about East African Asians. And of course, that's going to hit the Heath government, isn't it, under Idi Amin? It's going to hit the Heath government under Ugandan Asians. So this is explicitly racist, based on the colour of your skin and your birth heritage. Now, plenty of countries have that, of course, in this period, and some of them still do. But this is actually a Labour government passing an act, so it is a very problematical. But remember, it's Callaghan pushing that rather than Wilson. If you read the Crossman Diaries, for instance, because Callaghan sees himself as kind of, you know, protector of the working class Labour voter and protector of the trade union member. And lots of these people are pretty angry about access to housing, pretty angry about wages, which they perceive to be attacked by immigration of all sorts. So it's not Wilson really pushing this as much as it's Jim Callaghan. But it doesn't really work, because immigration doesn't fall that much and it continues to be high. And it comes in groups, doesn't it? So we've got a 40s, late 40s, early 50s immigration. Then we've got a big subcontinent Indian immigration, Bangladeshi immigration in the 60s. And then we have a European immigration in the late 90s, early 2000s with EU enlargement. So it's partly the sharp time frame which is doing the pushback from the populace. And for a government to really take the edges off that, it's very, very, very hard. And it doesn't really go. As you mentioned, the 1970 election, where immigration was highest and around where Powell had his seat in Wolverhampton, that's where the swing is biggest.
You know, thinking about parallels to today and in winning back red wall seats, right? Both those legacies of anti-immigration feeling and how you deal with that are going to be a question for Starmer. But there's also this question moving forward about thinking yet again about refugees. And here we have a situation where, you know, the political discussion of the moment is rather uniquely, again, about white refugees. This is not Heath in Uganda. And I guess, you know, it plays back, I think, on a lot of those fears about Eastern European white communities undercutting working class wages that we saw fueling into Brexit. And does that potentially make the current refugee crisis a kind of problematic terrain for, in a unique way, for Starmer. You know, I mean, that we just kind of put Brexit behind us, and all of a sudden we're discussing allowing a large community of Eastern Europeans into the UK.
Well, as I say, for what it's worth, I think that both the Wilson and the later Labour leaders attempt to speak out of both sides of your mouth and to go twin track, which is to pass a load of anti-discrimination measures while you tighten up on immigration. There's a real political trap there, which is you sound like you're insincere and you're not speaking the truth. So, for instance, the Blair government's attempt to say, oh, you know, very, very few immigrants will come from the accession countries, clearly leads to millions of people turning up, right? And that is what voters hate, rather than necessarily the immigration. Because actually British attitudes to immigration, especially in the 1990s and onwards, are pretty open compared to lots of other European countries. That's one of the contradictions of Brexit, isn't it? The Brits are pretty open to immigration. It's the speed and it's the perceived uncontrolled extent of the immigration which is the problem for voters, not the immigration itself. Remember, the single biggest group of immigrants are white in the 60s. They're Irish. By far the biggest group are Irish, and they're accepted partly for racial reasons, partly because of the jobs they do, for lots of other reasons. But this is by no means a populist that's like, stop immigration entirely. It's actually very complex. And I think a leader that spoke to people in a serious manner would do pretty well.
And I mean, drawing things together, really, and concluding, that's actually something that Wilson was accused of not doing. Certainly Tony Benn, whenever he raised the issue of immigration, he was told to shut up by Wilson. But basically, Wilson didn't want anyone in the party to talk about it. And of course, behind the scenes, Labour was doing some modest things to improve the position of black immigrants and their descendants. And, you know, but it was all on the quiet and yet still pandering to racist sentiment in terms of restrictions. But it was a very mixed sort of policy, very mixed sort of response to the question. And that's kind of a bit, I suppose, where Starmer is. He seems to be afraid to say boo to a goose on this issue. And that's very Wilsonian, I suppose. So I think on that bombshell, that may be a good time to conclude the podcast. And so it just behoves me to thank Laura and Glenn, and because nobody else is going to do it, I'm thanking myself for this hopefully interesting conversation about Wilson. And if you're one of those 25% Labour members who didn't know much about Wilson, hopefully you know something, and maybe you can think about what you think about Wilson now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.